The other potential issue for hijacking updates is, what if they're encrypted, right? HTTPS is going to prevent us tampering by design many of the things. If I especially want to fake a website that might host an update, one of the ways I can do that is with a lookalike domain or man-in-the-middling the legitimate domain. Of course, if HTTPS is there, it's harder to manipulate because I'm going to have to provide a server-side certificate and the user will get a prompt. This gets worse and worse with every update to our browsers. There's more and more hoops to jump through for a user to accidentally trust a certificate. But I will say, with proper planning, this isn't a big impact anymore. For example, if I registered a lookalike domain, I can use something like Let's Encrypt for free certificates. I just have to get a good domain, which, you know, may only cost me a few dollars as an attacker, and I can get free certificates. All I have to do is prove I own the domain, technically, and I can get nice, trusted certificates. Well, what could go wrong with protecting something like this? Well, think about what users do. For example, do you always type in what we show here, this HTTP, see how it says it's S? Does a user type in https://? And www.wellsfargo.com or whatever website they're trying to get to? No, they type in the actual domain. And sometimes people will actually Google for the domain, right? They type it in the Google field. Our point is, they don't type in the whole URL. If they don't start with HTTPS, maybe we can hijack the HTTP before it redirects to the HTTPS. SSL Strip is a great proof of concept written by Moxie Marlinspike. SSL Strip will look for HTTP requests, replace in them, in the body of the request, any link to HTTPS information, rewrite it as HTTP so that it's no longer following down, going further into encryption, that it will replace it with a clear text version. The idea, the user just goes to the plain site. If they do that, I can rewrite any of those contents with something like my header cap filters and rewrite them to HTTP links. So no matter what the user clicks on, they will stay in HTTP. They'll never get the certificate warning because they'll never hit the certificate situation. I log all the traffic. Anything like passwords or bank account numbers would all come in. And there's a few other magical things I could do as well along the same lines. Right? And that the way this works is a user just goes to a site but doesn't go to the encrypted version of the site first. Here's an example. With SSL Strip, here the victim's going to Kohl's.com, an e-commerce website. If they don't literally type in https://, it's a bit ambiguous. The browser makes a determination. Do I need to search for this domain? Do I actually send them and just assume it's a domain? How do I look this up? Different browsers behave a little differently on different sites. For example, in Google Chrome, you do a Google property that's hard-coded in the browser, it's going to know to do HTTPS. You can't avoid it. But if it's a different browser or a different site, you may not have that ability. The deal with SSL Strip is, once some other tool places it in the middle, like an ARP poisoning attack, SSL Strip will strip off the links to HTTPS. It can even act as a proxy and go directly. And that way it's encrypted between SSL Strip and the destination. And when it comes back, then it would get decrypted as if it were the client. And then it can write that text back to the victim. The victim sees HTTP all along the way. The HTTPS, the server, is going to see HTTPS. It's going to not know the difference. Meanwhile, the attacker can eavesdrop and inject and tamper with anything that passes through. Okay. Now, if browsers are checking everything correctly, any HTTPS activity would always be encrypted, and so SSL Strip will avoid that. It's not going to tamper with that. There's a few pieces we need to set up to make this work. SSL Strip is a application proxy, so we need to, one, have something that man on the middles. Two, we need to have IP forwarding turned on. And three, we need to divert it into the application and back out. So we have that. The first step we show on 195 for the SSL strip setup is just enabling IP forwarding. That's all it's doing. That way, if traffic comes to us, we don't send resets because it's not our IP address. On step two, we're redirecting port 80 traffic to force it into SSL strip listed on port 8080. Now, you could maybe run it on SSL strip on port 80, but there's a few side effects of doing that. This is one easy way to make sure we're directing only traffic in one direction to port 80, destination to port 80 in, and then everything going back isn't going to go through our proxy. It's only in one direction. So we set up an IP tables rule that changes that destination port, and we're in the middle, so we don't have to change the IP address. We can just stay in the middle. SSL strip listening on port 8080 is step three, and then we become in the middle. You can use Ettercap, maybe use a script or some other tool to become in the middle, and you can watch. SSL strip will log what it identifies as passwords, and we can also look at any of the traffic at that time. So this is a little bit of what it would look like. We can see inside of here my account, Cole's login, enter in the username and password, and sure enough, it collects it and it shows it to us. There are some possible side effects, by the way, since there's a lot of dynamic things that might be happening, like scripted web requests that use HTTPS. Here's an example of Amazon's page getting very confused, in the browser at least, when it gets stripped. Sizes and other things aren't quite calculated right, and so there's some crazy side effects here. Okay. Definitely not the best example because there's some glitches. You may have to sit down and tailor a program that performs the same thing as this SSL strip utility. This is the SSL strip plugin for Ettercap. It's not quite right, as you can see. The Bettercap one's a little better. And of course, you can write your own if you really have the need to have it work seamlessly. What about HSTS, though? HTTP Strict Transport Security is designed to say, look, I'm the website. I'm giving you this header to say I should only be interacted with HTTPS. If somebody's trying to strip off HTTPS and give you HTTP, you know now not to do that because I've already told you that me as a website, I will only accept HTTPS traffic. This gets transferred to the browser in a header the first time it sees that. And this is actually stored by the browser. Depends on the browser how it actually stores it. But it's remembered by the browser for a very long time, basically the lifetime of the certificate, more or less. And so if the attacker misses their opportunity to attack it the first time, then HSTS will protect that website in the future from an SSL strip related attack. Okay. It's not just while it's in memory remembering it. It will store it and persist against shutdowns, reboots, and all that. Okay? There's no continue anyway dialogue. There's no opportunity for a victim to get tricked into following it. It's actually hard to get around this problem if it was accidental. Let's look at one of the two options I'm aware of that lets us bypass or work around HSTS. This particular technique was documented in Black Hat Asia 2014. Leonardo, and I cannot pronounce his last name, I feel bad, actually called it SSL Strip 2. In some presentations, you might see it called SSL Strip Plus. But the idea with this tool is if it's keeping track, the browser's keeping track of the HTTPS requirement based on the host name, what if we trick it to go to a similar host name that isn't going to have it cached? And if there is like a wildcard DNS, or it's really us, the attacker, as a proxy, we can rewrite to the real website, and the browser is only going to remember the settings from us talking to it the first time. So in this example that we have the victim going to Kickstarter, and when it goes to Kickstarter, we give it some stuff, and there might be a link to www.facebook.com, but we tamper with that with SSL strip too. We say, oh yeah, there's a link in here to HTTP www.weaddextracharacters.facebook.com. And if there is like a wildcard DNS that the Facebook server will apply with, it will still actually work. Then the browser is going to get www, and we have extras we add in there. SSL strip will rewrite it and get the legitimate one all the way to Facebook, and again, rewrite the contents back. Okay? So it's a bit of a trick. We can pre-seed it by caching another site and not have an HTTPS rule, or we can redirect it dynamically to one that it doesn't have yet, and we can remove that header as part of our man-in-the-middling so it never sees it. So this technique was cool, again, published and documented and demonstrated in 2014. There's a few other things that come into play. This actually works quite well, this technique. There's another technique we don't have in the book that somebody I actually connected with at a SANS conference once, also in 2014. His name is Jose. I'm forgetting his name off the top of my head, but it also was a black hat, but Europe, not Asia. So far we've been talking about a black hat Asia presentation in 2014. From a gentleman whose first name is Leonardo. That's what we're talking about so far. The Jose's attack was he would actually man the middle NTP traffic, the time sync traffic, to force the HSTS record to no longer be valid. If you break time for that, it would no longer cache that. And when I say cache, it's over a period of years. If you speed ahead a few years, it would invalidate the HSTS memory from the browser. And that was another neat twist on the attack. So if you're looking for that, you can search for Jose SSL strip and 2014, and you will find the right article. It'll be like a PDF at Black Hat Europe 2014. SSL strip is available as an enhancement to BetterCAP. Here we see it running. Josh is logging into a mobile version of Slashdot, and you can see it does not have the HSTS header here. And we can take advantage of that. Now, earlier I talked about having an MITM proxy with an SSL strip script as we use a custom attack. Well, now that we're talking more about dealing with HTTPS updates, this is the perfect point to remind you that there is an SSL strip style attack following the similar attack techniques of peeling out the HTTPS and replacing it with HTTP wherever it is encountered. Do keep in mind though that MITM proxy for this particular feature is one of the slowest options for this. It is doing Python, and its object orientedness is going to be a lot slower than something hard coded in C. However, it is easier to customize, and for the sake of it being web browsing, maybe the little latency and slowness doesn't really matter when we're attacking. Okay? And don't forget, we still need to do the ARP spoofing or other way to become in the middle. That is just the SSL strip functionality we're taking advantage of from the fact that MITM proxy can run scripts for every connection going through it. Remember, we have our MITM proxy, MITM dump, and MITM web, which is a little more experimental, the web one. The dump is your TCP dump equivalent, is in its command line, and the proxy one gives you a text interface, much like your Cinia, where you can kind of select with the menu after looking at different flows, getting hijacked, much like you might be familiar with using burp or some other proxy. It behaves very similar. You have those options still to defeat the HTTPS protection when it comes to hijacking those updates. Do keep in mind that if you are doing this, it's really easy to accidentally collect credentials that are personal, not enterprise. And if you're doing a pen test, this might be against the rules of engagement because you're intercepting all HTTPS traffic. Most tools do not let you specify exactly which hosts. So you either need to write your own. You can also use some limitations of EtherCAP on the before and group one and group two, and add in your filtering some of the matching rules to make sure that it's only tampering with the right protocols. I mean, one could argue that this password might be legitimately something of concern to the enterprise. But it's more likely than not a privacy violation, and most countries in the world will have a problem with this. So definitely not a good idea to keep yourself out of jail. You should avoid that. We will also consider, I guess, we're not going to do this, but if you want to experiment with it, you may on your own. It's just, again, dangerous, so do be careful. You also have an option. The MITM proxy tool I mentioned earlier today as an alternative also has an SSL script, which does approximate this attack. It's not a direct porting of every feature, but it gives you the base start. It will work out of the box on some simple websites, but you may have to work through it. It's in the examples directory of the MITM proxy tool. Continuing our exploitations, what can we do about network devices? Well, we already attacked routers and their job by injecting routes. Creating a more specific route would force destination traffic to that destination to come through us. So we've already done that, but what else can we do? We could reconfigure the router with SNMP, but we can force it to go through us as an upstream router or something else, right? Maybe we can weaken certain protocols in a device if we can go in and reconfigure the device. Lots of historical problems with SNMP. We have SNMP version 1 is most prolific. It's very simple. 2C adds it's some checks, but there's really no authentication in SNMP until version 3. It's almost always UDP port 161. Okay. Now, your scanning tools may not properly enumerate it because sometimes there's no response, and that's perfectly acceptable. You might have to hunt pretty hard to find if it is on a special port. And once in a while, I've encountered that, but not nearly as often. It's usually on port 161. So what kinds of attacks do we have against the simple network management protocol? We have the idea of community strings, just guest strings. If we can guess the community string, I can eavesdrop on that in the network, and I won't have to guess it. If I do guess it via dictionary or some other brute-forcing way, now I can eavesdrop on what's going on. There might be some sensitive information in some of those records I can pull, the management information blocks. Like I can see, for example, if a machine supports the MIB that represents a process listing, I can see what processes you're running. And maybe there's something in the command line that is something sensitive, like a password is sent on the command line or something silly like that. I might actually be able to see that. But more importantly is things like access control lists, rules to firewalls can be managed over SNMP. So one thing you could do as an attacker is run Etercap. Etercap by default will log SNMP community strings, private or public strings. It will record because they're basically users or passwords, just in plain text. It will pull that in, and we could even give it a packet capture, and it will parse through it for us as well. Here we see an example of Etercap doing it, and even though this is a very complex password that we see here, this r0_c@cti, this is a very complex password. You may not notice it if it's just crossing the wire with a sniffer, but because Etercap can identify the protocol, say, wait a minute, that's the community string. As it passes through. Of course, Nmap could sometimes identify this. I've noticed, again, if there is an issue sometimes because the UDP port isn't standard port, it might guess the wrong UDP traffic, but you can force it to look for SNMP traffic. It will automatically identify the version of SNMP, and some of the community strings, it does have some guesses it will try. You may also notice good targets for SNMP, Cacti, MRGG, Nagios, Isinga, other monitoring software packages you might notice by the name of the device itself. Of course, any kind of a network device, router, and then maybe it's a gigabit or fiber uplink, ATM, MPLS, any kind of those acronyms that represent network connectivity might be a router or a bridge or some device of interest. That SNMP version scan, here we have an example. We're forcing it to do a UDP scan with the SU and port of 161 against an address, and we see something. Now, that is easy for us to do. You can see the enumeration it does there, just checking the, not everything in SNMP, but just checking to see that it can actually use that community string, the default one of public. When it is an SNMP version 3, as we show here, it just says, yep, that's definitely an SNMP version 3, but I can't ask the MIB for the uptime, how long has the machine been running, or the system description. We would have to do more of a username password guessing. One reconnaissance tool we could use, Fierce DNS, Joshua Abrams, Jabra, released this tool. He also ported it to Python, not just Perl. But what Fierce DNS is just think of it as an aggressive DNS enumerator. If it allows zone transfers and you point this at a DNS server, it might grab all of the records. Zone transfers aren't always enabled, though. Fierce DNS can also brute force common names. So it's not just about zone transfers. This particular screenshot, it does. And the tool surprised itself. Whoa, it worked. But it will guess common names. That's why they call it Fierce DNS. It actually will guess possible DNS names that are commonly seen and see if it is in that zone, in that DNS record. Once we've identified an SNMP device, a port listening, a service, then we can use 161, or we can use a different tool, but this is the one I tend to use because it's handy. I usually have it around. I use it to look for a valid community stream. Okay, so here we're showing that we have 161 pulling in community string list. That's what the minus C command line option shows us. SNMP.txt, and as an input, it's going to query all of the hosts in that host.txt file. That's how you interpret that 161 command. Now, what's in that host.txt file? Well, the genip command is just, we gave it a range of IP addresses here, and it just puts one address per line, and that's all it is in that text file. Pretty simple way to enumerate. Depending upon how fast things are, this will work in a few minutes. You could be a little bit faster. A Metasploit's SNMP scanner is a little faster than this. A Metasploit scanner will work similarly. We can just set up the range with the rhost variable. And threads here will actually let us run in parallel, and we might get more information. Okay? So we have that option available as well. Once we know what the community string is, to enumerate the MIBs, the actual records, the features that we can access, we can use SNMP check. It is a tool. We give it a target IP address, you give it a community string, and it will tell us everything it can via standard common records. Okay, so here's an example where it shows us this is a Brother printer manufactured by Brother, and it, you know, shows us some firmware versions, and we might see even more things. Like here we see user accounts and processes of running things because it's a Windows machine running SNMP service. Okay, so you never know what you're going to find. It's just good reconnaissance to go through and try to enumerate these things. Now, to actually take advantage of it, we can do something a little more devious. We have the ability to change configurations with SNMP if we have the privileged, the private community stream. We can have read and write access. We can change ports, change access control lists like firewall rules. We can upload a configuration file. We can download it first so we can change it and then upload it. Lots of potential for abuse. When we want to test this out, we could do a couple of things. SNMP walk is one tool that can enumerate different areas. We're just using it here to read one particular string, though. We're using it to read the location setting, and it tells us it's in Providence, Rhode Island. You know, whatever the manufacturer put there or the user put there, we've read, but we could basically deface it. Here we tagged it with the word foo. We use the private string. In this case, it was private with a one instead of the I. Very, very tricky. You know, password complexity rules aren't good enough. And here we're actually changing it. We're not just reading it. We're actually setting it equal to foo. And now we can prove that, yeah, we could have changed your configuration, but all we did was tag a descriptive field. We didn't change your firewall. So don't blame us if it broke. Kane does have some features for this. In the CCDU module, you can actually interact with the Cisco devices and the Cisco configuration. You can download and upload. Here, once we know what that read-write string is, give it a protocol, and it will handle the trivial FTP to transfer that configuration. If we wanted to do this a different way, instead of using Kane, we could use a tool. SNMP Blow is one possibility. It basically will give us an opportunity to force a configuration. So here we're first on the one-time setup, top of the slide here. We are configuring a TFTP server, get it set up for the TFTP boot directory. And then with SNMP Blow, we can use it to trigger the transfer. It's going to send the SNMP traffic that transfers the configuration. And that way we can download a copy of that. Bypassing SNMP ACL. Sometimes there might be a device that has some of those ACLs. So that say, like, only the administrative workstation is allowed to write to SNMP ports and actually write configurations. So with SNMP Blow, we could actually spoof. That's what the minus S setting is. We can actually spoof a source address. We would have to know what it was. It would just send the traffic. And since it's TFTP, it's running over UDP. And the SNMP is over UDP as well. The whole thing can be spoofed entirely if we needed to. So that's the download. And then for the upload, we can use SNMP set or we can use Kane to upload and transfer that tampered configuration. We've downloaded it. We go in and we change some of the rules, change the password perhaps in the configuration, re-upload it. And now we control that device. So we're going to introduce the exercise, pause and let you give you a chance to do it. And then I'll resume with a walkthrough to show you the solution. You will be using Kali. You're going to scan 10, 10, 10, 40 through 80. You could scan more or less, but to see the results that are in the screenshot in the book, that's what you'll be doing. You're going to first brute force the SNMP community strings, and then you're going to actually use SNMP to enumerate what you can via that protocol. So first, I recommend using 161 to look for those community strings. There's a dictionary that 161 ships with at this path. On your Kali VM, it's ones known to be observed in the real world, as well as ones that are default by many manufacturers. And I'm telling you to scan 10 to 1040 through 10 to 1080. All right. Now, again, you have to be connected to our lab network to see those machines. And if for some reason somebody changes a configuration for one of these machines, it might not show up in the results. Like if they disable SNMP with SNMP, which they shouldn't be doing. But anyway, your scan results will vary a little bit depending upon what kind of other things are happening on the network. All right. So use 161 to identify the correct community string, then use SNMP check to collect the information. All right. Those are your challenges. If you would like to work on your own, fight through using the tools, you will learn more than just reading the solution. All right, now it's time for me to walk through the exercise, and then we'll continue on with introducing the bootcamp, and I'll also walk through those solutions as well. So let's look at the SNMP exercise here. You can do this a few different ways, but if you either followed the book or found a matching, I find this is probably one of the easier ways. Let's switch to my Kali virtual machine. First, I'm going to use the genip command just to create that targets file. It's not too complicated. It just makes a nice little sequential list for things for us. Once I have that, it's still there. Now that I have that file, I can do some enumeration on it. The second piece, besides varying the IP addresses, we also want to vary what kinds of community strings. So looking at this, I can see that we have this dict.txt file, dictionary file. Pipe it to less so I can see some of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, admin, Cisco, community, default, private. You see lots of common different ones. This isn't just a password dictionary. It's one for known network devices, but it is very similar. So those are what we're going to use to guess. So here, 161, using the IP addresses from targets and the community strings from dict.txt, we're going to see what we can scan. And let's see what potentials we have here. It is UDP, so it can only go so fast. Assuming everything's running, we'll get some answers. And we actually got some pretty good answers. We see 10.10.40 is C2600. It is a Cisco device. Great, cool. And we see 10.10.70 is our lab server, which is actually gives us a kernel information. Cool, we see that. We see, of course, 77 and 80, and those are also, those are Windows machines, actually, to say it's Windows and what version it is. So that's pretty cool. We're able to do that. Great. Now notice that we have, you know, our private string, and we also have the public string for 40. So we saw private and public because it tries all of these. So the private is the one that's going to give us the write access. Public is the read only. Let's look at public against 10.10.70. And we can see lots of neat stuff. We see what ports are listening. We see what processes are running. There's just lots of great power in being able to do this. All right, so that's our SNMP check. Now let's continue. All right, that was our SNMP exercise. You might want to explore a little bit more if you had time, or just get started with the boot camp. All right, now I'm going to describe the boot camp and kind of give you some tips on getting through it and still getting value out of it. It's not just a matter of completing it. Do remember that the boot camp is also your opportunity to catch up on other exercises. Usually throughout this week, like Steve mentioned, we have the extended hours in the form of a boot camp on purpose. We really wanted to provide you every opportunity to complete the exercises. And sometimes our boot camp is extension of what we talked about, but mostly it's the real world application of what we talked about as proof of concept. So there might be a little bit of contrived exercises in our boot camps in 660, but for the most part, our boot camps are the real world versions. And we had simpler versions during the day to prove the concepts. And the boot camp is real world. And that's the general rule of thumb we have for the week. So we have a few exercises in our boot camp, but they're again designed to take it a little further than what we've talked about before. So even though you may be doing this at your own pace, I highly encourage you to finish any of the previous exercises you had not done before you try the boot camp, because you'll get more out of the boot camp if you have completed every other exercise. For your first boot camp exercise in 660.1, we're going to do one of those custom HTTP hijacking situations that we talked about earlier in the day. You have two essential pieces here. One is just reproducing some of the similar behavior that we have with something like EtherCAP or BetterCAP, just injecting into HTTP traffic with a different tool. Part of that is learning to research a little bit what kinds of command line options you need for this tool. You're going to have to try to find those command line options, look at the usage agreement, maybe even Google for some documentation if you prefer that method. But this is a common thing we have to do as an advanced penetration tester, is to find and discover, fight our way through syntax issues with the tool. Part of this challenge is to find those things. So that's why it's an extended hours. It may take you a long time if you're looking in the wrong places for this. The second part of this exercise is going to be doing an SSL strip style attack. And you should be able to see the value in stealing some credentials from that. And then we do have the OSPF exercise. You'll be using the Loki tool to hijack those routes. And we follow the finally with a Cisco configuration retrieval where we use SNMP command sequences to trigger a trivial FTP transfer of the configuration of a Cisco device. This first tamper HTTP exercise, your goal is to use a custom script that I created. You can read it, see how this works. It does have some of the SCAPI commands that you may not be aware of. We cover SCAPI on day 3, but it was important to have a simple attack here. We didn't expect you to be able to create the tool, as we haven't covered SCAPI yet, but you should be able to read the code and understand what it's doing fairly simply. Really, because it is such a simple script, we basically have the belief that it's less likely to break, more specific to our attack, easy for us to target both sides of the connection we would like to place ourselves in between. Okay? Using the MITM dump command, you could use the proxy to do it interactively, but my challenge to you is to use the MITM dump command to have a command line way to replace text. All right? So you have this as your goal for this exercise. Again, 2 parts. Review that HTTP hijack script. Pull it up in your favorite editor, and you can view the source code. Then when you execute it, you will get those prompts. First, you'll see the prompt for the adapter. Those of you connecting over VPN, you'll use tap 0. If you are bridged to the VPN that your host is connected, or you are doing this in some other capacity, you would enter the adapter that it is supposed to be using anyway, such as ETH 0 or whatever the network adapter you're using on Kali Linux is shown as. It's going to do the ARP man in the middle with a SCAPI crafted packet in both directions to both of those targets. Those victim IP addresses are the second and third prompts the script gives you. If you quit this script while it's running by hitting Control C, that is actually caught and used to trigger a re-ARPing of those victims back to the original state. And we also have, as part of its activity, adding a IP tables rule that forwards traffic passing through on port 80 to port 8080, where MITM dump's transparent proxy will be ready to translate and use something like the SSL strip plugin. Okay? But for the first half, as I said, part 1, we can find by using MITM dump help. You might be able to use MITM dump and other command line options to trigger a different usage, depending upon the vintage of the tool and the tool itself, of course. You might get different usage, common examples especially. Your goal is to replace every image tag with a defaced image. It really doesn't do anything additional payload-wise than anything else we've done with our man-in-the-middle exercises in 660.1 so far, but the point really is to get used to using the MITM dump command line tool. Once you have the proper command running, the victim, your Windows 10 victim, you can browse to kittenwar.660.org, and when you mouse over that login link at the little pop-up you see in the bottom left here, you can tell that it's using HTTPS. At this point, SSL strip is not working. Otherwise, that would be stripped off. It would show HTTP. So this is the not working state. The attack is not running. Your challenge is to add that in on the part 2. Okay. Here is some of the contents of the SSL strip example script that we're using. You can see how if it starts with HTTPS, it's going to rewrite it on those location headers on the bottom half of what we show here. On 238, we also have the response body links. Anytime we see HTTPS, it's replaced with HTTP. Once that's running, it should work. So if, again, You want to challenge yourself to find this organically? Have at it. Go play with the tool. Find the command line options. Come up with your command lines and make it work. I have several examples following the next few slides before the next exercise. Continue when you're ready to see the answers. Now, you may have came up with a different solution, but for HTTP tampering, for this particular challenge, I prefer this one. The replace clause that we have here with this file syntax, the at file name at the end of the command, we have a line wrap here. This should all be one line. That at shows that we're not literally replacing img with the words and the characters /lab/day1pwn.html, but if we place some contents in that file, we don't have to worry about command line escaping as much as if we try to do it all on one single line. So I like using that at symbol for using the file to hold those quotes. Like, since we're doing HTML, those less thans and greater thans would look like shell redirects unless I escape them, and it might get a little ugly. So I prefer to use the file technique. So we have our mode of transparent, meaning that it's not a web browser assuming we're a proxy. We need it to pass through us, and we will replace any of the things in the response. That tilde S is for responses. A tilde Q, sometimes people will mistakenly use, that is for requests. And we're not making the browser request different images. We're making the browser receive something from the server that says to get a different image. And that works pretty well if we do something like this and have inside the contents of pwned HTML the replacement. We're replacing img with img space src equals a full URL, this pwned JPEG, for example. And then, you know, we can close out the rest of that image tag somehow, or treat the original destination of the image src as a second thing. That's why I in here put an ignore the rest equals. I want to be sure that we're not just injecting that src tag and leaving the old one. I'm moving that src attribute into a new tag here named ignore the rest. And of course, a browser doesn't know what ignore the rest HTML tag means. It's going to ignore that. What we'll see as the victim is we should see a pwned JPEG for every matching image tag in the response. Okay? What would the part two solution look like? Here, I can run our HTTP hijack, placing ourselves in the middle. Here, though, we're using MITM dump, mode transparent, and using the SSL strip the way it is. We don't even have to modify anything. It just runs. So here for this, we just had to figure out that mode transparent and the SSL strip. To ensure your success, all you really need to do, clear out IE's cache just to be safe, especially if you're trying to troubleshoot here and trial and error is part of your process. Click in your Internet Explorer 11 browser settings, that's that gear, shown as point one. On number two, you can select the safety option. On step three, you can delete the browsing history. That's going to force it. If you close the browser, that's probably the most reliable way to make sure nothing's been saved. I always like to do that, so I know I'm testing something, and it's not some side effect of a browser, you know, trying to cheat on how long it should remember things for caching. At this point, we can move on to browsing to the site. Here, if we browse to kitnoir660.org, again, you don't type HTTPS as the victim, and that man-in-the-middle proxy is going to see the clear text link to HTTPS, replacing those all with HTTP. And when you mouse over this time that login link, you can see that it's HTTP and not S. You can even prove this by clicking on that login link, typing in some guy in some pass in as that password here, and you can see, sure enough, that it is collected by our attack console, proving that we're able to strip out HTTPS and collect those credentials. Here we go. Loki. So this is basically what we talked about earlier. I will demonstrate it, but you're going to inject a route to become in the middle. OSPF routes might be protected with MD5 digests. Since there are routers exchanging information, they're not changed very often. So it's a good opportunity for us if we see those routes being propagated as an attacker. Loki's not too old of a tool. It's semi-recent. It's still a little buggy in a classroom environment because it's designed to just be a one-off. If you're doing this at the same time as somebody else against our same router, it might get a little crazy. We've done our best to improve it for the classroom experience by slight improvements inside of the Python code. You might also have problems with some of the packet capture related libraries that Loki needs, depending upon, you know, how much you've updated Kali if you're not using ours. It's one of the reasons we stick to our version. So it does have a password cracking module, but since the standard only allows up to 16 character passwords, it just crashes. It says, I'm not checking. I mean, I didn't really check for that. So we're going to have to feed it a 16 character password dictionary file, nothing over 16 characters. This cut command is going to cut out anything, basically truncating, cropping out everything past 16 characters from this SQL map dictionary that comes with Kali. And we'll be using this user share wordlist loki.txt file. Okay, so if you're asking yourself how the solution told me to use this loki.txt file, but I don't have it, it's because you skipped this setup task. Okay, so another thing you can actually see that the route works, there's a looking glass. The idea of the looking glass is you can kind of see a reflection, an image of what the routing table looks like. There is a cron job on 10.10.10.70 that prints this out in HTML form. The cron job fetches the configuration every minute. So it is not updated constantly. You may have to wait a full 60 seconds and refresh your page to see the update, but you should be able to see the state of the router at that point in time, give or take 60 seconds. You're going to start Loki by running the Loki command. You'll click on the gears here in step one, which will pop up this window. You will be selecting ETH0 if you're live in the classroom. If you are doing this over a VPN online, you will be using that TAP adapter. And you should, after 10 to 15 seconds, see some OSPF traffic. If you do not see it here, start Wireshark and see if you can see it in Wireshark. All right, you should be able to see that. Now, it says here, auth crypt. If we're doing this with Wireshark, it would also show us crypt, and it would show us the key ID, which is down here in the bottom. The key ID would actually be not 0, it would be 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever. We don't know what it is on this screenshot by itself, but if you see the packet in Wireshark, it would actually say a key equals 1. And that's how you know to set this value to 1. And then you will be able to do this auth-type crypt. The key will be used to inject your new routes, okay, once we establish that connection. So first, now that we have this, we can select it. You're going to select the cracking tab and tell it to crack that password, okay? Again, you're going to need that loki.txt file. Here's the second time I've shown you the command to use the loki.txt. Don't check the use brute force option. It won't ever end. There's no value in that for our exercise here. Use that dictionary file and it will work. Your next portion of this task is to become a peering router. Insert a route. Suggestion is to use 172.17. Whatever you're using as your IP, the last number in your IP address in your octet, just use that number, whatever that is, and look for that in the looking glass, okay? So we'll walk through that solution after I finish describing the last stage of the bootcamp. There's only really one page for the introduction to this final exercise in the bootcamp, the SNMP configuration theft. What you'll be doing is exploiting that ability to transfer the configuration file. TIP 1040 is a router that is vulnerable to this because it has a weak community string. You need to find a read-only, find the read-write, and retrieve the Cisco IOS configuration file. Now, there is something we've done to kind of prevent damaging this for other students, but please just don't change it. Consider it to be good proof that you're able to download the configuration. You can write the location address and tag it if you like, but no other configuration changes, all right? So those are the challenges you have before you. I will pause and give you a chance to do that, and then I will resume with solutions to all three exercises. All right, I'm going to walk through the solutions to our three bootcamp exercises for 662.1. First, again, the first exercise, the point was to try to force you to research a particular tool, MITM Proxy, MITM Dump. I've been using more of recently, and it's such an active project. The command lines are changing quite a bit. You Google or search for how to do something, and it's different in this version from a different, yet a new version. Some of these particular features I chose, like this replace from a file technique to conduct the defacement, actually has changed three times that I've seen in this tool. So I've found it to be, again, one of those things that I look at when talking about advanced penetration testing. Fighting your way through syntax changes between different versions of the tool is natural progression. So let's look at this. I'll switch over to my Kali virtual machine. And firstly, you can try the man page. And we know we actually want to deface it. So let's look at searching for replace as a keyword. And I can see there's replace a pattern or replace from file. Spoiler alert, it's easier to replace from file generally because I don't have to worry about quotes and other escaping of the quotes I'm replacing into it. And the command line might interpret that as a bash thing instead of a, you know, HTML thing in the browser. So replace from file really is what we're looking for where it does. It does kind of have a regular expression style replacement. So we can kind of fight through that a little bit. That's one piece of the puzzle. The other part is, it's like we need a filtering rule for the MITM proxy or MITM dump to use. So we can go back to the beginning of the page. I'll just quit and start it again. And say, what is our general options? We can look at several things for the actual proxy. We see replace from files that we were seeing as some of those options. We already saw that. Intercept, that's something much more like what we wanted to look at. But we're not really seeing much else in this particular page of MITM emphasis here on proxy. So if we look at the bottom here, we can see there is some more documentation. And if you do a MITM tab, you notice, and I've mentioned it in the slides and lecture, there's an MITM dump that is a TCP dump version of the tool. So if I man that, I don't see anything. I'm going to have to try to experiment with it, see if I can get some usage. So MITM dump minus H is a good thing to try. We see some similar syntax here as well. But we also see that's server replay, not client replay. It actually differentiates that. So we see a few other details here, but we also want to see some of this configuration. We didn't see this before, but there was an MITM proxy conf, key values, flags. There's a lot of settings we haven't seen before, so we might want to hunt that down and dig a little deeper. Okay, there's lots of options on that. We can see that there's slightly different replay things, which we're not so concerned about, of course. But what I wanted to draw your attention to, was just the option that you might have to explore quite a bit on some of these. We don't really need to deal with patterns. We can do the replace from file. So we can see this. If we try to start using this then, we can give it a try. And like most things, it's maybe not going to work in the first try, but MATM dump to stay in command shell. It's a little easier to try to reproduce. And we said replace from file. And I've got this pwned HTML file. If you want to look at its source, you can. It's just that image source, goes to this IP address, ignore the rest, and just a little bit of a tag. This doesn't really matter. But if we're, you know, ending a HTML tag, we might be able to do something. Part of the value of this side effect is it's garbage. And if it's injected, we can kind of tell it in the web page because it's not properly formed HTML. It could be anything. You could make it all nice and pretty, make it more ninja, less pirate, as I like to say. But it's up to you on how you want to better identify that. So that's the file we're injecting. And this isn't going to be good enough. By the way, I'm purposely showing you the building point. And what do we see? It says argument time, too few clauses, pwned HTML. So it did not like that. Basically, this replace from file needed to happen as an optional argument, but there's still something missing. Let's look at that man page one more, or the usage one more time. Let's see if we can give it some garbage, and it sees, see options and filter. There's a filter thing. And when we purposely looked at this with H for help, or we can try minus minus help, maybe we get different help, same help as before, we can see replace from file and the path. But it says replacements are in the form of slash slash this with separated community character. But this is just the path. So that would be the pattern. This is the path, but how does it know what to replace with? And so it's purposely going to force you to try to find it. What we do is we look at that documentation to see that we can replace the request, the response, or something else about that traffic. Just like we did with EtherCAP and the port, source, and destination, we can differentiate the source response. So that is part of it. Now, the other piece that we have is the actual HTTP hijack. So I've just shown you the script here. We've got the victim IP address, victim 2 IP address prompts. And then this is basically just telling you which MAC address it's attacking from, just as a sanity check. And it enables the forwarding, creates the spoofing packet, destination address of all MAC addresses that says, I'm going to be just this other victim. And if this rearp pushes things back, and this is that IP tables command that is going to redirect traffic into MITM dump or MITM proxy, and it puts IP forwarding back the way it was as well. Okay, so a couple of error checks like, hey, I couldn't find the MAC address, I couldn't find victim 2. Putting the firewall rule back and things like that. Let's go ahead and try to run it. So HTTP hijack says which interface? Well, I'm on ETH0, so I'm using that one. Victim IP is my, first I'm going to use my Windows client, and then the server of KittenWars is 10.10.70. And it does tell me what it is, and it says it's poisoning it. I can confirm that if I go and use an ARP. Let's do it. And 70 does have the same MAC address as 75.99, so I am getting poisoned at the moment. Great. Now, this minus T is a transparent proxy mode. Again, if you dig through the documentation, you'll find that replace from file we talked about before. And then since that replace string was, again, the example was slashes, but it said any character. We saw that on the screen. We use colons here. S basically means in a request, not in, sorry, in the response. It would be an R for request. And S, tilde S is for the response. Replace an image tag with whatever's contained in this file. So that's what MITM dump is going to do. Now, newer versions of MITM dump have actually deprecated this. You have to do a long form of the command line option. Again, if you have used the tool, you've been in that situation where the command line options change. So now that this is running and it's being man-in-the-middled, Let's see if the attack works. Kittenwar.sec660.org. And we see some pwns sprinkling up, right? And yes, it's kind of weird. Why did this image not get replaced, you may be asking yourself. And we can view that very quickly. In the page source, let me search for pwned. And we can see my injection replacing that image, even the ignore the rest and the file name, breaking the HTML. But what we get at is this other cell you should see. Here's the image tag. Remember that own the rest, pwned HTML. Then that source is a leftover from the original image source. Notice that the replacements that worked had lowercase. The uppercase IMG did not replace it. That's what this kitten is here. So I was doing a case insensitive match. This is on purpose to show you that sometimes things go off. If I had an image alt or something else besides a space and an SRC, it also would not have looked the same. So little value add there in the lessons learned. So we were able to deface the kitten website. All right, great. Now we can file our bug bounty submission and or whatever. We're able to prove that man-in-the-middling and HTTP injection is possible. Next, we'll look at OSPF. Now, I'm going to use Loki. First, though, I do need to create that dictionary file. So, again, Loki doesn't like passwords greater than 16 characters, so this is going to give us a limitation of the first 16 bytes of those passwords. And with this, now we can run Loki. Now that Loki is running, let's click on the gear, select ETH0. Again, you'll be selecting TAP if you are on the VPN. Now, sometimes Loki does a good job of flashing the tab when it sees that kind of traffic, but it doesn't always show up. So let's go click over on it and see if we see anything yet. Nope, we're not seeing it. Oh, it did change the color right there, but not the ISIS one I'm on. Switch over to OSPF. There we see there is a hello. We see it's a crypt. So let's go to cracking tab. Not use brute force, but let's select the word list we made. It's in the day one folder. Or did I not? Was it not in the right folder? Let me back up. the one that I made, the file that I made, was in user share word list Loki. Okay. So let's switch back to Loki, browse for that file. It's not in the day one folder. User, local, user share word list is where we saved it to. Our new one is titled loki.txt. It's only 11 megs instead of, it's still 11 megs, but it's not like the RockYou database. It's limited to those 16 characters. So we're gonna use that. We have the only router possible selected. We did not check brute force. Let's just try this dictionary and click on crackpw. And right away, giant zombie is revealed to be the password that generated that crypt hash that it's using to prove that it's okay. Now that we know what's legitimate, what we can do is we can click on connection. I'll leave area zero, auth crypt, type in giant zombie, the one that we cracked. And the key ID, you actually can see if you run Wireshark. Let me just do that to prove the why. Graphical error, doesn't matter. Sniff on ETH zero, and we'll look for OSPF and apply the filter. And when we look at the OSPF protocol, we can expand it out, look for, you know, crypto authentication. Here we see type 2 auth number. That's the actual hash. And if we go back to the OSPF header, we see it's crypt key ID of 1. So that's why we know to set that to 1. And this is what information it uses to do the crack. So that's how we know it even happened. All right. Now the other thing I want to do is pull up that looking glass so I can see evidence of attacking. Routing.html. There it is. Our machine, this is how it is untampered with. What I'm going to do is inject a route to the backbone, and it'll be for the 172 subnet. I'm going to make a smaller subnet so that'll actually show up as a more specific one. So that's great. I'll leave that running. Switch back to Loki. We have Giant Zombie. Wireshark told us the key ID was 1. And now I'm going to say hello. Now, if there's not been a problem, then I will be able to peer with it and everything will just work. If, though, there's a mismatch in my subnet mask and the routers or something it doesn't like about me, it's going to shun me and not let me fully connect to it, fully peer. So if you do have a mistake or a problem or something happens, you might have to change your IP address and try again. Let's see what happens. I send it a hello packet. We're checking the state field to go from hello. We're going to see two-way, X start, loading, and full, hopefully, when we're completely trusted by, there it is now in full. Now it's fully peered, and I can go to the injection sub-tab down here and say, 172.16.99.0 with a net mask of 255.255.255.0. And I can say, look, I am going to be your router for that. Let's inject that and see if it likes it. Now, again, it may take up to a minute. We'll have to see exactly when this thing updates. But I'm hoping to see my results show up there as well. Also, too, there is a neighbor ID here, but I should see myself peered in the show ISPF, show IP OSPF neighbor commands in Cisco iOS, which this is reflecting for us. So let's hit the refresh page. If I'm lucky, I do see that there's my 10.10.75. I am fully a backup router, fully peered with it. I do not see my thing yet. I may have to wait a few more, maybe even 60 seconds. There it is. I just had to have a little more patience. There's my injection that I did. So you see where the 172.116.0/224 is subnetted. And anyway, again, the more specific you are, the priority goes to you, for everything else being considered equals. The priority is going to go to you if you're more specific. So you want to spoof, or you want to man the middle traffic to Google's DNS at 8.8.8.8, create a route just to 8.8.8, and you're more likely to get that. Okay. That's our Loki route injection attack. Going to stop attacking. All right, finally, for our last exercise in the boot camp, I'm just going to demonstrate that real quickly. It's not too complicated, not a lot of commands to run, and it's just kind of neat to be able to do this with a network device. So let's play around with this as a little end cap on our activities for the day. So we have 10.10.10.40. as given to us, and we want to find the read-only, the read-write, and the configuration file. That's our goals. So let's do that. I'm going to switch over to Kali, run 161 against its own dictionary, against 10.10.10.40, see what I get. I get a public and a private, not real creative strings. So great. The private is, of course, going to give me my read-write. The public is the just read-only. So now that I've got those, I could continue to use command line tools, but setting up a Trivial FTP server is kind of a pain. If you've ever done that before, it's kind of tricky. Problematic. So I'm going to switch over to Kane, so we haven't used Windows that much. And I'm going to use Kane, which is already installed in your Windows VM. Hopefully Windows Defender isn't somehow updated and blocking it, but go ahead and run Kane. You can switch over to the CCDU tab here, and here, if we have anything, it will be displayed. I'm going to click on the plus sign to add to the list, put the 10.10.10.40, and the read-write, not the read-only, was private, and there it was able to transfer the running config. I can view the configuration file. It opens it up in text, so maybe I should save this, save as. Then I see where it is. I'm going to right-click and open with, and open it with WordPad, so it actually does the line read-writes better. And I can see it's got a Cisco Type 5 password, which is easy to crack. and I can copy that. Or it's not as easy as type 7, but you know, that might be of something of interest. Let's see if we can do anything with that. Let's go. This is type 7 only. Yeah. I was all excited when I saw it, just out of natural thing, but it's type 7 that's the weak one. Type 5 is usually much better. But anyway, you can see the natural progression of going and finding the password. Or now I could upload the configuration with my own password and control the router, but that's beyond the scope of this exercise. So I hope you found that valuable. Again, with anything today, any of the 660.1 material, feel free to ask your instructor or the subject matter experts for help. If something doesn't quite seem right or you have questions on why something works, it's not clear, feel free to ask for more information. And to the next session we will have, we'll start off with the beginning of 660.2, be some crypto, and we'll get into some post-exploitation. It will be, we'll get into some pretty deep details quite a bit in the next section. See you then.